Luke found it difficult not to step off the slidewalk to pursue Akana. Her thinly veiled threat that she might continue on to Jitipatan without him, might withdraw her promise to lead him to his mother's people, was not without power. But that threat was also nakedly manipulative, and recognizing that, he could resist the emotional blackmail. Luke had to know his own mind, know if he could allow himself to continue the journey. The old familiar demon of duty had re-entered his consciousness during the conversation with the shipwright, and he had to either answer his conscience or silence it. And for that, he needed information. When Luke returned to the skiff from the tiny Utharis office of the New Republic Defense Fleet, carrying a tactical briefing memorandum, Akana had not yet returned. Taking advantage of the privacy, Luke locked himself inside while he reviewed the information on the data card. The situation in Kornak Cluster had escalated. New Republic forces had clashed with the Yevathan fleet at Dornik 319 while trying to enforce a blockade, and dozens of fleet recon probes had been destroyed while on deep penetration missions. 5 battle groups of an expanded 5th fleet had actually moved into the cluster, and smaller units were actively searching for the former Imperial shipyards that the Yevatha had taken over. But the real source of concern for Luke was the first confirmation that Jitipatan had been involved in the fighting. The recon ship sent there had identified a Yevathan thrust ship in orbit. Before being fried, the probe had reported that the destruction of the Hikig commune on Jitipatan, estimated at 13,000 strong, was probable. Balancing that bleak prospect, at least in part, was the report from Dornik 319 that the Yevathan warships were carrying hostages taken from the destroyed colonies. If the Falanasi had not died in the attack on the Hikig commune, they might now be prisoners of the Yevatha, aboard one of the more than 600 ships of the Duskan League fleet. Suddenly, Luke's journey to Kornakht seemed joined to Leia's crisis at home. He knew now that he couldn't turn back. He had to go on. Whether from contempt or carelessness, Han was neither blindfolded nor rendered unconscious for his transfer from the prison to the brig of Pride of Yevatha. At the spaceport, the transport that had delivered him was met by guards and one of the Yevathan officials who had been present for Barth's execution. One guard and the official climbed in the Delta-type Imperial shuttle after him and sat down. The official began to speak.
"I am Tal Shan, Proctor Kojin to the Viceroy."
"I'm sure your mother is very proud of you." Tal Fran loosed an open-mouth hiss that Han thought might be a laugh.
"I have studied your past. We know how important you are to your people. We also know that Lieutenant Barth was not important. There were no stories of his life and heroics. I was not surprised when you let him die."
Han's flash of anger overwhelmed his intention not to be drawn into Talfran's game. "You scum! You think you understand us, but you haven't the first clue. What you did to Barth makes him important to us, just like what you did to those colonists all over the cluster made them important to us. We're not like you. We remember our dead. That's why our fleet isn't going away." When the shuttle arrived at the flagship, Han's escort led him to the brig. Located adjacent to the large landing bays, each holding area was equipped with water taps, ventilation, and food dispensers adequate for up to 1,000 prisoners of war. However, there seemed to be no more than 100 prisoners in the area to which Han had been taken. Most took little or no notice of his arrival, but a small group, perhaps 20 strong, formed a ragged circle around him as he made his way toward a water tap. More than half a dozen species were represented in the circle, and they looked upon him with a mixture of dull-eyed curiosity and suspicion. They introduced themselves and named their home worlds, places like Polnei, Hikig, and Morning Bell. "There seem to be survivors here from all the colony worlds," he said. A woman who had introduced herself as Inara asked,
"Are we the only survivors?"
Han swept his gaze across their faces.
"I don't know. I'm just like you. I don't know what's going on out there."
The days following the presentation to the Senate of a petition of recall against President Leia Organa Solo were full of moments that made Hiram Drayson despair. Moving quickly in the wake of the ruling council's vote, both Fleet Intelligence and New Republic Intelligence had intervened to prevent the news of Han's capture by the Yavetha from being released with the petition. Stripped of its supporting argument by the blue and silver secure seals, the petition ought, by all rights, to have foundered. But a ruling council had never passed a petition of recall against a Senate president before, and novelty alone gave it an undeserved gravity. Nothing could rein in the rumors that blossomed to fill the information vacuum. When Coruscant Prime led its morning packet with a feature titled, "Where is Han Solo?" and the New Republic news grid answered with "Princess Leia's personal war," Drayson knew that the battle had been lost. He met with Akbar and advised, "You may as well release everything you have concerning Han. At this point, the official denials make it look like we have something to hide. Instead, Leia should be getting a flood of sympathy over Han's situation." Akbar nodded thoughtfully.
"I have urged her to that course, but she is protecting the children."
Alone in his office, Admiral Drayson continued to pore over the gossipy news stories about Han's absence. One that speculated on marital trouble between Han and Leia as the reason no one had seen him lately was typical. Drayson had already made a decision about what was needed to change the tone and tenor of the public and political consciousness. The crisis had to have another face. He spent the next hour browsing through the personnel records of the casualties of the engagement at Dornick 319. In the end, he came to the same place his first instincts had said he must go, to the young Granan survivor from Polnei, Plat Malar. During the Yvethan attack, thinking that his end was near, Malar had recorded a heart-rending message about what he had witnessed. Obtaining one of the few existing copies of the Hollow, Drayson passed it on to a zealous young journalist at the Life Monitor. Her feature appeared in the rolling queue. Its appearance brought Plat Malar's story to the attention of nearly 500,000 viewers, including the senior night producer for Sunrise and the Senate correspondent for Roll Call. By dawn, Malar's achingly poignant plea on behalf of the inhabitants of Polnei had reached more than 40 million ears on Coruscant and ridden the hypercom trails to 80,000 other New Republic worlds. There were 100 things Leia should have been doing that evening other than lining a garden path with brilliant white sisalia blossoms, but none of those other things had half the appeal of burying her hands in the cool, moist soil as she tucked each plant gently into its new home. She was interrupted by the message that someone urgently requested an audience with her. The visitor was a Pakwe, a short, yellow-green alien with a wide carriage and a sway-backed waddling gait. He was swathed in tattered reception hall finery and smelled strongly of bitter salts.
"Princess Leia, it is a great honor. I am Belazebus Orn, Extraordinary Council of the Pakwapori."
He took a step forward.
"I think that we can help each other, Princess. You are having difficult times with a certain party. It's said there'll be war. I may have some information that could be of use to you."
Leia regarded him impatiently. "It's a little late for word games. Be specific. What information?"
"Not information, exactly. More a thing. How you use it, that's for you to discover."
Orn produced a small black box from a concealed pocket.
"It is a way to send messages to Nazos, to Nelspar. Completely untraceable."
It was Leia's turn to take a step forward. "Where do you get this?"
"From the Viceroy. His ship destroyed mine, you remember, at Eastport the day he left, when your negotiations ended. He promised me restitution, but it was an empty promise."
"He gave this box to you before he left?"
"Well, yes, of course."
"And you've been in touch with him since he left?"
"Only to remind him of his promise."
Orn stopped, realizing the contradictions.
"We had an understanding. He was unfaithful. I will help you now."
"How did you help him? By spying for him?" Orn swallowed nervously and tried to smile.
"Now, Princess, how many secrets does someone like me. No, nothing, less than nothing. I pretended. I deceived him.
With a single quick stride, Leia closed the distance between them and dropped into a Jedi fighting stance.
You took my husband away from me. Princess, surely.
It took only one blow to silence him, one more to bring him to his knees, and one last to send him sprawling unconscious. The spotlight of the next morning's staff strategy session was on the two intelligence chiefs, each of whom had been professionally embarrassed by the previous day's events. For Admiral Graf, head of Fleet Intelligence, the problem was explaining how the Malar recording had escaped Fleet custody. Graf tried to assure everyone,
"We are continuing to backtrace the access logs for all existing copies."
For General Carlos Rican, head of New Republic Intelligence, the problem was to find a way to turn the damage Orn had done to the New Republic's advantage.
"I'd like to suggest another way we might use what we've learned," he said.
"I'm listening."
"We have the tools for a small campaign of disinformation. We have a working black box and a desperately willing turncoat who'll do most anything we ask. What if we just let him keep talking to the Yveatha?"
On Pride of Yveatha, Nils Spar was inspecting his new breederies. There were three of them, each with 48 alcoves. Picking cells at random, Nils Spar checked to make sure that each was well-suited for the nurturance of a birth cask. Only when he was satisfied did he return to make himself available to Talfran. They met in the upper command lounge, which provided a spectacular view of the Star Destroyer's broad 8-kilometer-long spearpoint hull.
"Is it not invigorating?"
Nils Spar said as Talfran was led in.
"To see how much power has passed into the hands of the Blessed. Can there be any doubt that we are the children of the All, the inheritors of the ancient glory?"
The Viceroy turned away from the viewpanes and accepted Talfran's surrender with a touch.
"How far shall that glory carry us, my young disciple?"
Talfran bowed. "I have had a new insight into the heart of the Pale Ones, Darama. We must not send them the recording from the viewing hall. It will move them to anger, not to surrender."
Nils Spar flexed his large hands.
"Does my memory deceive me, or was it not you who counseled that we must show Leia our hostages?"
"I did so in error. Only fear will give us the result we desire. Fear for themselves, for their own safety."
"And from where does this insight come?"
"From the vermin. I spoke with him aboard the shuttle."
Nils Spar was clearly unconvinced.
"And yet there is this. An hour ago, the Proctor of Information Science brought to me news of a conversation one of his guildsmen had with Belezebeth Orn."
"The Pakri's spy? He has given us nothing of value for many weeks."
"Perhaps he has done so now. The vermin reports that Leia does not believe we hold her consort. Surely this confirms that your first counsel was correct. We must show our hostage to the Vermin Queen. That will surely change her tone."
Talfran walked the length of the viewpane wall and back before responding.
"No, Darama, I cannot agree. There is nothing in what he says which promises that knowledge of the truth will deter her aggressions. Han Solo answered me with defiance and threat. Surely her fire is of the same temperature as his."
Nils Spar directed his gaze out at the great vessel.
"Then what course do you now counsel to remove the infection from these stars?"
"We have not managed to make them fear us. But there are already shadows they will not enter. And the greatest of these is the fear that the horrors of the past will be repeated. We can confirm their prophecies."
Along with six other top officials, Leia watched Nils Spar's recording. It began with something they had not seen before, the emblem of the Duskan League, a double circle of three-pointed stars on a scarlet background. Then Nils Spar appeared. This time he had company. Standing beside him was a human, wearing the black uniform of an Imperial moth.
"I address the strong, proud leaders of the vassal worlds of the New Republic. I bring you an announcement and a warning. As I speak, the enormous battle fleet under the command of Princess Leia continues its reckless invasion of Cornut Cluster, territory that has belonged to the Yveatha for more than 10,000 years. Up until this moment, we have shown great restraint. Against the urging of my military commanders, I have held our own powerful fleet in reserve, except where the lives of civilians are in danger. I know that the good citizens of the New Republic are even now trying to drive the deceiver Princess Leia Organa Solo from your capital. But she has bought many friends on Coruscant, and others have reason to fear her. The Yveatha can no longer risk our future on the hope that Princess Leia will find her conscience and leave us in peace. We must protect ourselves. By refusing our offer of friendship, by threatening our very existence, Leia has forced us to seek friends where we otherwise would not have.
Niels Spahr raised a hand in the direction of the man beside him.
We have invited the Empire to return to Cornut Cluster as allies.
Leia sputtered. That's completely unbelievable. They despise the Empire.
I have come to you to announce that the Duskan League and the Grand Imperial Union have concluded a treaty of mutual assistance. Moth Trag Brathis is commander of the battle fleet now stationed here.
The uniformed man nodded. Nilsvar paused, and the Hollow tracked out the bridge viewports to show an Executor-class Star Destroyer, along with at least half a dozen other Star Destroyers flying in formation over a dusty yellow planet. Then Nilsvar moved in to block the view.
If the New Republic does not withdraw from our borders, if the new president, whoever that might be, does not swiftly acknowledge our just claim to these stars, the combined strength of the League and the Union stands ready. Your actions will determine the course of the future.
The screen went black. Leia threw the controller down on the table. Does anyone here think this is real? Rican frowned.
Perhaps this pact is real and was concluded months ago in secret.
Leia shook her head. Why reveal it now?
Why not? Since he's already told us about the Imperial ships, he has nothing to lose by telling everyone else.
Leia turned angrily to Rican. What do you mean, telling everyone else? Did this go out to the entire system?
Rican raised an eyebrow. Yes, it appeared in the system in a standard diplomatic packet.
Nana Ardeng cleared his throat.
Excuse me. We're not the intended audience for the Viceroy's message. That bolt was aimed at the hearts of our citizens.
Tholaton was uninhabited, save for the smuggler's hideaway known as Esau's Ridge, nestled at the base of a towering cliff. Chewbacca had come to this isolated place for information and specialized supplies. His contact, for Meiji, was an aged Yao with a vast stock of memories and connections, both of which he hoarded closely. For Meiji considered Chewbacca's request.
Cornut Cluster. Maps, inhabitants, hyperspace routes, ship designs, planetary defenses, sensor grids. Very rare. Expensive. Very well, come back 2 days. No more then.
Chewbacca did as instructed. The price was almost unspeakably high, but the value was undeniable. A smuggler's annotated copy of a Yveathan navigational map, an even older Imperial autopsy report on 3 Yveathan corpses, a recording of Nilspar's address to the New Republic stamp just 40 hours earlier. Fomeji pressed another object on Chewbacca. This one, a data card.
Old Imperial Star Destroyer shield codes. Sensor jam frequencies, defensive fire patterns. These are readily at hand. No demand. Historical value only. My service charge will cover.
Standing, for Meiji offered his hand.
Still like, Han. Old trickster. Smuggler made good. Deliver greetings if you see him.
Lando lingered in the auditorium as long as the question of whether the vagabond could heal its wounds hung in the balance. Then, at last, a thin band of slender, crisscrossed stringer material began to appear around the edges of each opening in the hull. The openings began to close, stitched by the material the ship was producing. That was when Lando decided to leave, feeling as though he had witnessed an exhibition of Kella ingenuity more impressive than the lost orrery. He called over the suit's comlink.
Lobot, the hull breaches are nearly repaired. I'm heading back.
I would be glad to relay a message to him.
Rebio, what are you doing on Lobot's comlink? What's going on there?
Pardon me, Master Lando, but Master Lobot left his contact suit in our keeping. He said he was seeking the threshold of awareness.
On his way to rejoin 3PO and R2, Lando had only crossed through two chambers when there was a burst of white noise static.
Blast, Lando said. They're back. Then the ship groaned.
In the sudden darkness, Lando was thrown against the face of the chamber. He implored the ship,
please don't try it. Not after taking hits like these. The vagabond paid him no mind.
Moments later, with the roaring growl and violent shaking at a terrifying peak, the vessel twisted real space until it opened, then fell through Infinity's door. Twenty-seven hours after she had taken custody of the Keller remains, Joy Ycroft hand-delivered three data cards to Admiral Drayson at his home on the north shore of Victory Lake. Drayson's face was haggard and his embrace distracted.
I expected you to transmit the sequences to me in a secure packet several hours ago.
That was before we knew how extensive the sequences are. She moved past him into the grand parlor. And I wouldn't have gotten to see you again. A tired smile, making a bid to reach his lips, Drayson followed her.
You're saying that you found something surprising?
She settled in a reclining chair. That's it, exactly. This species has three, at least three, different types of cells that contain genetic material. The ordinary somatic cells have 62 chromosomes.
That's on the high side, isn't it?
Drayson settled on a small padded bench stool nearby.
Go on.
Yes, it is. But that's the smaller part of the whole, she said. The species has two other kinds of genetic material as well, in two structures in different parts of their bodies. I call them code capsules, because they're encapsulated in a solid protein coat. There are billions of these capsules in that carcass. She gestured at the data cards. Your DNA and mine together wouldn't fill one of those. I barely got the creature's genome to fit on three of them. As near as I could tell, almost 5% of the creature's body weight is genetic material. That's unprecedented.
What does it need with all that?
That's a good question, she said. I don't know.
The instant Lady Luck left hyperspace, its slave circuits relinquished control. Doc Picard showed his teeth and hissed.
This isn't supposed to happen. Where's the beckoning ship? Maybe we were stood up,
Bijo Hammock said. Tysden, the comm operator, grunted in surprise.
Excuse me, Colonel Pak Picard, would you take a look at the comm cue, please?
Pak Picard spun his couch back toward the controls.
When did that show up?
Just now, said Tysden. Is that your personal comm code, sir?
No,
said Pak Picard.
How very interesting.
What? Hammocks leaned forward. Tysden pointed. Ready to transmit notice for a White Star dispatch personal to the colonel.
There's a simpler way to satisfy our curiosity,
said Pak Picard.
I would like the bridge to myself for a few moments. Colonel Hammocks, I believe you were headed aft.
Hammocks nodded. He ducked through the hatchway. Page me on the observation deck, Tysden said, climbing out of his couch.
When he was alone, Pak Picard entered his authorization code.
Colonel Pak Picard, pending dispatch contains letters of introduction, recently acquired at great expense. Trust they will open doors for you. It bore an apparently authentic Fleet Intelligence watermark and seal, but was unsigned.
Admiral Kerizin's friends,
Pak Picard thought.
They should not know that I am in this ship, but they do. And they are still looking after him.
He drummed his thumb claws on his temples as he considered his response.
Letters of introduction can only mean the Keller genetic code. Assistance I requested through proper channels and was denied when the task force was recalled.
There was no real choice before him.
With a few light touches on that display, Pak Picard entered his send authorization and returned a clear-to-transmit message to his unknown benefactor, noting the ship time as he did. At their present distance, the transit lag for a round trip to Coruscant should be something more than 40 minutes. If the reply came back too soon or too late, he would know what meaning to give it. He keyed the comm.
Agent Tisden, please return to the bridge.
As soon as Tisden sat down at the displays, he leaned forward sharply.
Hold on. I have a deep scan contact alarm. Colonel Paprikat, there's something coming in fast.
What sort of contact?
Asked Paprikat. Tisden shook his head. The system's giving me an on-the-fly translation. Ah!
What?
We are heading for a rendezvous with, and I quote verbatim, the gallant and eternally vigilant patrol destroyer Tobey of the Grand Imperial Navy of the Constitutional Protectorate of Prakis.
Sounds like we definitely don't want to be here when they arrive,
said Hamax, who had reappeared in the companionway.
Paprikat looked to Tisden.
How long?
Not quite 6 minutes. Paprikat pushed the yacht's throttles forward. The sudden acceleration knocked Hamax back into the companionway.
I suggest you find a flight couch and strap in. We may need to discover not only how fast General Carizian's yacht is, but how agile it is as well.
Hamax came forward and reached for the weapons controller.
I have retracted the laser cannon, said Paprikat. This is a race, not a fight. I will jump us out before I let us be caught. But I am willing to take some risks in order to receive the complete dispatch.
What's in it that's so important?
Hamax asked.
The code that allowed this ship to pass through the vagabond shields at Kamar Askelon.
But we have that. And the code which would have allowed our D-89 to follow it in,
Paprikat continued.
The next time the vagabond asks us a question, we should know the answer.
If we ever see her again,
Hamax said with a lopsided frown.
We will.
I'll set up the jumps if you'll tell me where we're going next,
Tisden said. Back to Karkonth and Anomaly 1033?
No. I have been thinking about what happened to us being brought here by an automated system override,
said Paprikat.
I find myself asking what the Keller would have done if once having launched this vessel, they found reason to recall it.
What do you have in mind, Colonel?
Said Hamax.
I have in mind for us to go to Martha Obex, the vagabond's point of origin,
said Paprikat.
We will set up a hyperspace beacon there and transmit the sequences we just received.
You mean to call her home?
Said Hamax. Paprikat nodded, human fashion.
And then we will wait for her.
Lando Calrissian cursed under his breath as he dragged himself through the narrow inner passage toward where R2 thought Lobot could be found. The cyborg had stubbornly refused to return to where the droids were waiting, forcing Lando to shed his contact suit and come after him. But the passages were twisty, and it was difficult to find enough purchase on the surface to keep moving. The maze would have been impassable in gravity, at least for a human.
Lobot!
He called ahead.
How about a little help?
You sound close by. Just keep coming.
What are you doing in here? Are you stuck and too embarrassed to admit it?
I am occupied.
Occupied with what?
When he was answered with what seemed a pointed silence, Lando changed the subject.
You know, we jumped out.
Yes.
One more toe push brought Lando to a point where two passages merged into one.
The jump didn't sound good, he said, pausing there. A lot of shaking and rattling we hadn't heard before.
There was much damage.
Lando started again in the direction of the voice.
Yeah, I saw some of it. Are you feeling all right, pal?
Fine.
Really? I gotta tell you, you sound a little flat.
I am occupied.
That again, said Lando. Well, if everything's all right, it would have been nice if you'd answer the messages R2 sent to you for me.
Impossible.
What's impossible? Lobot?
Impossible to reply. The channel was in use.
Lobot's voice was at last starting to promise that Lando might see him around one more twisting turn.
If there's some reason why I shouldn't come up there, maybe you could tell me now.
No reason. Come ahead. You are close now.
Yeah, you said that once before.
I was not listening with my ears.
Yeah, of course, said Lando. I make that mistake all the time.
Pausing, he pulled the cutting blaster from the slash pocket of his flight suit and slipped the stay loop over his wrist.
You will not need that,
said Lobot. Lando's head jerked up. There was still no sign of Lobot in the passage ahead.
You spying on me, buddy?
Again, Lobot did not answer right away.
We are aware of you.
Drawing a deep breath, Lando reached out and pressed his palms against the inside of the passage, resuming his awkward floating crawl with new determination.
You'll have to pardon me for intruding. I thought you were alone in here,
he called as he scrambled along.
I hope I can count on you to make the introductions.
Yes. A little farther, Lando.
Ahead, the passage turned sharply, hiding what lay beyond. Lando let the blaster come into his hand before going around the bend. The next section of passage had a gentle curve which limited his view to 20 meters or so, but in those 20 meters, no fewer than 50 smaller side passages joined it. The openings were puckered in appearance, and the side passages dark. Pulling himself forward cautiously, Lando directed the beam of his hand torch down the first of the side passages. Barely 2 meters in, the branch was completely blocked by what appeared to be a rounded plug, lighter in color than the enclosing walls. The configuration put Lando in mind of concussion missiles in their launchers, or assault pods in their drop tubes. Spinning in midair, Lando aimed his light into another side passage, and the next, and the next. They were all blocked.
No, not blocked, he thought, filled. In just the same manner, by ellipsoidal objects potentially large enough to enclose and imprison a human being.
Lobot, where are you? Lando said quietly.
Molo nag aiken nag molo kran aiken sket.
The voice came from a side passage another few meters away. Lando pulled himself along one-handed until he reached it, then pointed the beam of his hand torch inside without warning.
Lobot was floating inside, his feet toward Lando, his head against the object filling the passage.
When the intense light reached Lobot's face, he raised a hand, squeezed his eyes shut, and turned his head away. That was when Lando glimpsed a shocking sight. The right side of Lobot's head was bare. There was only an outline of white skin and a pattern of socket holes where the interface band had been.
Lobot, what's happened?
Ida Kronmolo sket Iken sket Tupa Vol.
Drawing himself closer, Lando grabbed Lobot's foot and shook him.
Hey, come back to me, pal.
Lobot flinched at the touch, but ended his recitation.
Talk to me, or I'm going to have to pull you out of there. Maybe I'd better do that anyway.
No!
The vehemence with which the word was launched was part passion and part fear. At the same time, Lobot's hands slammed against the sides of the passage, his fingers digging deep as the substance there yielded to provide him with secure handholds. Only then, with Lobot's arms no longer obscuring his view, did Lando realize what was happening. Half of the interface band was still in place on Lobot's left side. The other half was attached to the curve of the object beyond. A network of fine wires no longer than the span of Lando's hand connected the two as a tether.
Starfire! You found a way to talk to the vagabond!
A smile crept onto Lobot's face.
Yes.
To the vagabond, or to these things?
Lando gestured with the light.
There is no distinction.
Is it conscious?
It is aware.
Lobot opened his eyes and looked at Lando for the first time. Lando wedged himself sideways in the opening of the side passage.
What kind of conversation are you having?
It is willing to give me information. It will not give me control.
Ask it where we're going this time.
It is hurting,
Lobot said.
I think it is going home.
Lando contemplated that information for a moment, then gestured with the beam of light.
What are these? Eggs?
No. These are Kella,
said Lobot.
The ship is the egg.
The New Republic's Fifth Fleet stealthily patrolled Yavathan territory. All seemed to be quiet. Then at Star System ILC-905, the picket ship Fulna spotted a Yavathan thrush ship dropping out of hyperspace. Suspecting that it might be headed toward one of the Black Fleet shipyards that the Yavatha had taken over from the Imperials in a bloody rout, Commodore Brand ordered 3 new Republic gunships to follow. The battle that ensued lasted only 11 minutes, but it was a decisive one. In the first few minutes, the gunship Vanguard fell under a fearful fusillade from 2 Yavatan thrust ships. Each thrust ship had 8 main batteries, spaced in such a way that every approach was covered. Their fleet could not get through the shields to the shipyard. The orbital shipyard the Imperial Navy had called Black Nine was unarmed, but not unprotected. In addition to the collision shields needed by any space-based complex, it was equipped with ray and particle shields comparable to those of a star destroyer. Both of its guardian thrust ships, Tholos and Rizeron, in addition to 8 main batteries, also carried 40 fighters in 4 bays along the equator, and 4 10-tube reloadable missile launchers. With their enhanced Imperial shields, they were formidable warships. The greatest weakness of Tholos was the inexperience of its Yavathan primate, Pardran. When the New Republic ships appeared, Pardran responded out of the old instincts that govern fighting among the Nitaka. Those guidelines said, "The closest threat is the greatest threat. In a fight of unequal numbers, dispatch your weakest opponent first. To discourage others from joining a fight against you, charge a newcomer immediately. Hold nothing back when you go to kill." So it was that Pardran's orders to his gun crews kept changing. To attack the gunship that first appeared, then the cruiser that joined the fight, then the bombers as they flew past, then the cruiser again as the bombers retreated. If Tholos and Rizeron had continued their combined attack on Vanguard, they could have destroyed it. If Pardran had allowed it, Tholos could have swept the battlefield clean of New Republic fighters and bombers before turning its attention to the gunship Indomitable. And if the Yavathan fighters had pursued the blue flight team of bombers toward the shipyard, or black flight toward Rizeron, the outcome of the battle might have been different. But Pardran followed the rules. The New Republic did not. And one daring plan, carried out by the K-Wing bomber pilot Desiji Tuketu, known as Took, changed the course of the battle. Took flew down and parked his E-Wing on the narrow seam between the shield around the shipyard and the shield around a thrust ship, to give his fellow pilot, Skids, a clear bead on the scene. Skids dove down and fired. An enormous explosion ripped the thrust ship free and sent the shipyard into a slow, tumbling roll. Indomitable fired at what was left and watched the jumble of vessel turn into a spreading cloud of burned and twisted debris. Nils Spar gently caressed the Marinas, hanging in Alcove 5. In only 3 days, it had more than doubled in size, and the surface had taken on a rich iridescent sheen that foretold a superior nesting. There was a noise behind him, and the viceroy turned to see Tal Fran standing in the doorway of the cell.
Tarama.
Tal Fran knelt, his head lowered, his neck bared.
My Proctor Cogent.
With a half stride forward, Nils Spar lightly laid his hand on the back of Tal Fran's head, keeping him in the posture of submission. His fighting crests were a purplish red and swelling quickly.
Now, let me be certain of my memory. Did you promise me that the prospect of an alliance between myself and these Imperial vermin would fill Leia with such fear that she would not dare make war against the Blessed? Did you say that?
Tarama, what has happened?
Nils Spar pushed Tal Fran's head down sharply until his neck was bent to the breaking point. He made a fist with his other hand, and the long, sharp dew claw slid out of its retractile casing.
The vermin destroyed Black Nine at Prildas.
The resistance went out of Tal Fran's body.
I give you my blood as a gift to your child.
I will take it.
Nils Spar struck with such sudden violence that Tal Fran's head was severed completely, while the body dropped to the floor.
For once,
There was no craft or subtlety in a transmission from Nilspar. Leia watched the hollow with her arms wrapped tight against her body, one hand covering her mouth. When it was over, she left the room, her face white, her eyes dead. Akbar was little better off, despite having looked away through the worst of it. Senator Ben Kilnam, chairman of the Defense Council and Leia's friend and mentor, scowled with contempt. Alone in his office, Drayson wore a mask of cold rage. They had seen Nilspar savagely beating a bound Han. The beating went on until Han was bleeding freely from his mouth, his nose, from gashes on his face and arms, his chest. The beating went on until his blood was smeared on the bulkheads, the deck, and halfway up Nilspar's powerful forearms. The beating went on until Han could no longer stand when the Viceroy dragged him to his feet, not even with a wall to support him. For long seconds, Nilspar had stood in a half-crouch over Han's crumpled form. Finally, he had straightened and turned to face them. Staring into the holocam, he had wiped at the blood with the back of one hand, then sucked his hand clean. Then he spoke the only words heard throughout the entire horror.
Leave Cornact now!
Akana was the first to discover the Yavathan starship orbiting Jitadan. As soon as Mudsloth dropped out of hyperspace on the fringe of the Dornick 628 system, she slipped away to the service compartment. There, she entered a deep meditation, submerging herself in the current and searching for the presence of the Falanasi Circle. Staying at the skiff's controls, Luke first performed a sweep with Mudsloth's feeble sensors, then closed his eyes and entered his own reverie, connecting to his new surroundings and searching for local disturbances in the force. Neither he nor the skiff found anything of note, but when Akana rejoined him, she told him of her discovery of the starship. "How do you know? Can you actually see this ship?" Luke asked.
"It's difficult to explain," she answered. "Let me try to show you."
"In a moment. Explain first."
"What does it matter how I know? I know."
"It matters if you expect us to base what we do on what you've told me." The unspoken tensions dating back to Utharis were fully awakened by then. Her expression was more hurt than angry.
"Have you become a skeptic now? You no longer trust my gifts?"
"Akana, I know there's more than one source of knowledge and more than one kind of truth. All I ask is that you help me understand the source of your insight. That will help me know what weight to give it."
"Very well. I will try to explain."
Akana frowned as she searched for the right words.
"Where the current touches self-awareness, there is a tiny ripple, as when you sense a presence with the Force."
Luke frowned. "But I can't feel anything here. Nothing more than the energy of the ecosystems on the fourth and fifth planets. Nothing of consciousness. Nothing of will."
"It is not consciousness or will that matters. It is the profound essence of being, nothing more. I can perceive the Yavathan crew just as you would perceive a handful of sand I scattered on the far side of a pool. From a distance, sometimes you can see only the effect, not the cause."
She smiled.
"But you must be very still to see even that, for you are also of the current, surrounded by the ripples of your being."
"So what you sense is the crew of this ship?"
"Whether they are crew or cargo or captives, I can't say. I only know that there are many thousands there, orbiting Jitapatan, and some smaller number on the surface below."
Luke nodded thoughtfully. "The colonists, they must be here to settle the planet." At her questioning look, he added, "I heard some rumors in Taldak that the Yavatha were expanding their territory by taking over the habitable worlds."
"And you trust these rumors because..."
"Because they came from the fleet. I obtained a tactical briefing on the war."
"So, you already knew of the ship's presence and said nothing of it to me."
Luke corrected her. I knew that a ship was here at one time. I didn't say anything to you because I couldn't. I take seriously the oath that allows me access to secure data. I wouldn't tell your secrets to them, either.